My sense is that in that kind of situation, we should err on the side of liberty, including err on the side of liberty of self-defense.
Hi, I'm Ted Ballacher with Reason TV, and today I'll be sitting down with Eugene Volokh. Volokh is the Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at the UCLA School of Law. He's also the founder and co-author of the popular legal blog, The Volokh Conspiracy. When it comes to threats to free speech, do you see them coming these days mostly from the left or from the right?
Well, there are some from each kind. If you look at the polls, it turns out that liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, have pretty much the same percentages supporting speech and supporting restriction, regardless of what their politics are. So in fact, the sense that, say, racist speech, most Democrats, most liberals want to suppress it, most Republicans want to protect it, and there's some big gulf between them, the polls just don't bear that out when it comes to the rank and file. Now, it does turn out, though, that if you look not at the voters or at the justices, but at the backers, at the intellectual, academic, and institutional backers of some restrictions, there is something of a liberal-conservative divide. For example, campus speech codes seem to be mostly backed by a combination of mostly liberal university administrators and professors. On the other hand, there are also attempts to restrict speech from the right, and that's both speech, for example, that's sexually themed. But even beyond that, generally speaking, it's more conservatives than liberals who are in favor of firing government employees, or at least giving the government the right, broad right to fire government employees for their speech, including for whistleblowing speech and the like.
So do you think the First Amendment, would you say that it enjoys more popular support and more real-world protection than other amendments in the Bill of Rights?
It's very hard to compare the relative force of various kinds of constitutional amendments, in part because they're written in different ways. So the Fourth Amendment, for example, many people say, well, the Fourth Amendment is not being protected enough. But the Fourth Amendment restricts not searches and seizures. It restricts unreasonable search and seizures. So does the Fourth Amendment, is it being enforced less strictly than the First Amendment? Well, it's hard to say. It may be just because it's written less strictly that it ends up often authorizing a lot of government action, whereas in the First Amendment context, generally speaking, government action restricting speech is viewed much more skeptically.
If you had to choose one or two of the biggest threats to free speech, free expression these days, what would it be?
One is this notion of hostile environment harassment. And that is the notion that speech, people expressing their views, people making jokes, sometimes people posting sexually themed material, sometimes people making political statements or religious proselytizing, can become legally punishable discrimination simply because it is, and I'm quoting here the very vague language of the law, severe or pervasive enough to create a hostile, abusive, or offensive environment based on race, religion, sex, sexual orientation, and the like. And this could be in employment, in education, and public accommodations. There is the limitation that it's only actionable that way. It can only lead to a lawsuit if it creates a hostile environment for a reasonable person. But it's obviously a very vague and very broad standard. So it's become essentially a nationwide speech code for America's workplaces, and not just imposed by the private property owners who run the workplaces. They, of course, are entitled to restrict speech on their property and by their employees. But rather, it's imposed by the government, that employers are being coerced into suppressing certain kinds of speech by fear of massive liability.
I'll give you a chance to take us at Reason TV to task. We have this series we call Nanny of the Month. One month we singled out the Alabama Supreme Court for upholding a state ban on selling sex toys. You said that that was improper. We shouldn't have tarred the Alabama Supreme Court as being nannies. Why is that?
It's the job of legislators to impose only those legal rules that are genuinely necessary to protect individual liberty or some really very, very important social interests. But that's not the job of judges. The job of judges is to follow the law and to enforce the law. It's far from clear to me that the Alabama Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, protects the right to have sex toys. One could argue that it should, but it's perfectly reasonable for a court to say, look, there's nothing in our Constitution that interferes with legislative judgment here. This could be a silly law, it could be an illiberal law, it could be a nanny law, but it's not our job to act essentially as protectors against the nannies. The protectors against the nannies should be other legislators, should be the voters. And if you don't like the nannies in the legislature, vote them out.
So by definition, judges can't be nannies?
So I think judges could be nannies when it comes to judges creating legal rules. Historically, in the American and Anglo-American legal system, many basic legal rules of contract, of property law, of tort law, even historically of criminal law, have been created by judges. The earliest restrictions actually on private sexual conduct were actually judge-made rules. Likewise, a lot of tort law rules are judge-made rules. So I think judges could be nannies if they set up tort law rules that are unduly paternalistic, for example, that end up protecting people so much from ordinary hazards that they essentially drive useful products that people should have the choice to use and drive them off the market.
Let's talk about gun control in a post-Heller world. What's the main takeaway of the District of Columbia versus Heller Supreme Court decision?
The Supreme Court held in D.C. versus Heller that the Second Amendment secures, among other things, an individual right to keep and bear arms, including handguns, in self-defense. So what I think is going to be happening under the Second Amendment, what we've seen happening, and what will continue to happen even if the Supreme Court holds in the coming Chicago cases that the right to keep and bear arms applies to state and local governments, is if there's a total gun ban, that will be struck down. Total handgun ban, that will be struck down. Possibly some other laws, maybe total bans on carrying guns, that's it. Open question whether those would be upheld or not. Maybe bans on possessing guns in public housing complexes. Occasionally you have some such laws. Those might be struck down. But bans on so-called assault weapons, various waiting period laws, licensing and registration laws, I think courts are going to say those are permissible regulations rather than total prohibitions.
Let's talk about how media coverage of gun incidents affects public perception. If there is a gun incident, almost by definition, if you see it on the 11 o'clock news, it's because someone has shot someone with a gun. But most actual gun incidents, you can imagine a perpetrator breaking into your house. You merely brandish the gun. You don't fire it. Mm-hmm. The guy runs away.
So media coverage of guns is skewed in various ways. One way is my sense is that, at least in many media outlets, the people who write about them and who cover them are actually somewhat anti-gun. And as a result, the coverage ends up being anti-gun. There's also just the bias that that it's news if a gun is used in a way that is easily noticeable. It's not news if a gun is used the way that most guns are used, which is somebody breaks into somebody else's home. The homeowner, say, takes out a shotgun, pumps the shotgun. The burglar hears that familiar sound and runs away. That's a very common and useful use of a gun. It's not going to make the news. So those are two reasons why news coverage is biased, I think, against gun rights. At the same time, entertainment, I think, is biased, whether intentionally or not, in favor of guns. Guns are glamorous things in television programs and in movies. My sense is also that people who use guns in movies use them much more successfully than guns are actually used in real life. The fact is that, especially under combat conditions, it's very hard to hit somebody the first time around. I don't think that television and movies accurately capture that fact. As a result, they make guns seem more effective than they actually are in many respects. And, as I said, they seem glamorous.
Do you, generally speaking, agree with the more guns, less crime thesis?
I think it's very hard to tell what the precise effects are of allowing more law-abiding citizens to get concealed carry licenses. It is pretty clear that the overwhelming majority of people who get concealed carry licenses use their guns responsibly. We have shifted from an environment where about 10 states allowed every law-abiding adult to get a concealed carry, or nearly every law-abiding adult to get a concealed carry license, to a situation where we have 40 states that allow nearly every adult to get a concealed carry license. And we have not seen any massive increase in either crime generally or in traffic shootings or crimes of passion or what have you. So the fears of the gun control proponents have certainly not materialized. On the other hand, whether there is a modest increase, very small but measurable increase in crime as a result, whether there's a small but measurable decrease in violent crime as a result, very hard to tell. There are competing arguments, competing data sets, and competing models. I think that's something that there needs to be more research on. But it is pretty clear that it has not had massive effects one way or the other. My sense is in that kind of situation, we should err on the side of liberty, including err on the side of liberty of self-defense.